All right, we are in Acts chapter 22. We're in verse 17. So far what's happened is Paul has made it to Jerusalem, got some good news, bad news situation when he talks to James and the elders. Good news is a lot of people have been coming to Christ in Jerusalem. Bad news is they're zealous about the law and they think that you're trying to lead people astray and want to kill you. Paul goes out as a means to make amends, to pay for the Nazirite vow, and for himself to go through a purification process in the presence of everyone. While he is doing that, or after he has done that, somebody from the province of Asia, a Jew from the province of Asia, probably in Ephesus, notices Paul and begins to start a riot, primarily because the condition in which Paul left Ephesus whenever he left. And that was Demetrius on a rampage against the Jews, Christians, although he wasn't distinguishing between the two, probably as much as the Jews would have liked. As a result, his violent tactics, the persecution, fell on the Christians and the Jews as a whole in Ephesus. Paul, though, had already been in Macedonia. This Jew that was there for the festival in Jerusalem sees Paul's not happy with what's been happening. So he starts a riot around him. They start beating him because he also accuses them that he has brought a Gentile into the temple courts where they weren't allowed to be, more than likely Trophimus, who was from Ephesus, from probably the same region that the Jew was from. They start beating him up. Roman commander comes and says, "What's going on here?" They stop with blood all over themselves saying, "Nothing, nothing, nothing at all." And he ends up arresting Paul with two chains, which we talked probably refers back to Agabus and his prediction of what was going to happen to Paul in Jerusalem. And when he talks to Paul, Paul basically says, "Hey, let me talk to the people." And he says, "You speak Greek and Aramaic." And he begins to speak. He starts telling his people, number one, his ethnicity. Number two, his mission. And that was initially, or his actions, which initially was against the Christians. And then we're right now in the middle of his conversion. And I don't know if we didn't really talk about it too much, but if you're noticing, his conversion account that he's describing here is a little different than what we find in chapter 9. Not drastically. It's not like Jesus doesn't appear to him. But even the fact, this is where we even get the detail that it happens at noon. And we'll actually even get, every time Paul tells his conversion story, which is how many times in the book of Acts? Three times. Every time he tells it, we get actually a little bit of different information, a little bit more information. Something that continues to paint the full picture. Verse 6, he's in Damascus, sees a bright light. "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you?" "Lord, I'm Jesus of Nazareth." "Well, that's a problem. My companion saw the light, didn't understand. What shall I do, Lord? Get up, go to Damascus." He does. Verse 12, a man named Ananias comes. He's a devout observer of the law, not a detail that Paul would leave out, especially in light of what they've been accusing him of. He stands before them and he says, "Brother Saul, receive your sight." He was. "God of the fathers has chosen you to basically be a witness to the righteous one. Get up and be baptized." Verse 16, he does. Verse 17. "When I returned to Jerusalem," when was that? You have the Damascus events. Remember, more actually happens in the Damascus events than what he even gives here between 16 and 17. How long was between verse 16 and 17 of chapter 22? Around 3 years. Galatians 1 says he was in Arabia, Damascus region for about 3 years until he finally then went up to Jerusalem where he met with, at the time, only Peter and I believe James, and no one else really met with him until Barnabas, remember later, argues for him to actually have a hearing. "When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance. I saw a vision and saw the Lord speaking. 'Quick,' he said to me, 'leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me.'" Did we ever hear that detail earlier on? No, but what did happen whenever Paul was in Jerusalem last time? What happened? What's that? Yeah, they ended up sending him out because there was persecution coming to him. And where was he sent? Not Antioch. Think hometown. Tarsus. Remember, he's converted in Damascus. He stays around there for 3 years or so. Ends up going up to Jerusalem. Has a little bit of a ministry there, but that's not going well. So they send him off. He goes to Tarsus until Barnabas finds him. "Quick, leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me." "Lord," I replied, "these men know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you." When the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. Then the Lord said to me, Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. That's the problem. I'll send you far away. And you got to hear Paul going, okay, good, thank you. To the Gentiles. Oh, no. I'll stay here and die. It's cool. Do not send me to the Gentiles. I'm a kosher Jew. I'm kosher. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this. At this point, Paul has been emphasizing that the Lord had been telling him this. The Lord sent Ananias. The Lord appeared to him. The Lord tells him to leave Jerusalem. The Lord tells him to go to the Gentiles. And at that point, you could ask the question, who's going to argue against God? But the moment he says to the Gentiles is the moment they say that has to be blasphemous. I don't care what you've said. I don't care how you've developed this in line with the will of God. I'm not accepting it. They listened until Paul said this, that he was going to the Gentiles. Then they raised their voices and shouted, Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. Why is he not fit to live? Because he defiled himself by doing what? Being around the Gentiles. Because they are so obsessed with their bigotry and their love for what keeps them separate from the Gentiles. That whenever he says, God said to go to the Gentiles, they say, that's blasphemous. That's blasphemous. Why? Because that is not the God we serve. And Paul says, I understand, but what am I supposed to do? You almost hear Peter's argument in this from chapter 10 and chapter 15. If this is the way God does it, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Disobey him. I think it's better to obey God rather than man, I think. Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. Why? He wants to be a light to the Gentiles and not burn them. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air. Sound familiar? Sounds like the event he just referred to, doesn't it? For whenever Stephen says something similar, they scream, rid the earth of him. And they start throwing off all their cloaks. And what do? They start throwing dust in the air and charging him. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and throwing dust into the air, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. This is a weird occurrence. He's going, first of all, why does he want him to be flogged? What is the confusion of the Roman commander here? He doesn't speak Aramaic or Hebrew. He has no idea why the people are ticked off. What he does know is Paul's the problem. Paul is the problem. So we're going to beat this guy until he tells me what the issue is. I don't know what they're yelling and screaming about and throwing junk into the air. I don't know what's happening. Bottom line is, he's the problem. So we're going to beat him until he tells us. There's a couple of laws you need to know. I'll put this on the test. Whoa, if I throw my pen. Okay. Three laws. I'll write them on the board so that way you can actually... Every one of them begins with the word lex, which means in Latin law, the law of. First one is the lex portia. Portia is the way we pronounce it. Porcia is the way they would have pronounced it in Latin because the C gets the S sound. No. It gets the hard K sound. So porcia is how they would have pronounced it. Lex porcia. Lex porcia. Is the law against binding a Roman citizen? Putting him in chains at all. Why? Why would that be a law? If you're the Roman Empire and you're making laws, why would you make this as a key law for the Roman citizens? You're not even allowed to put him in chains. Why? Yeah, because if you shame a Roman citizen by making him walk around in chains like the subjects of the empire, you're shaming all of Rome. Somebody could look at you and say, that's the way you treat your citizens? Well, it's not honorable to be Roman. And in fact, I don't want to be Roman at all. They try to give certain benefits to the Roman citizens so that it brings honor to the whole empire. And one of them is Lex Porcia, which says you're not even allowed to bind a Roman citizen. Number two, Lex Valeria. This is a law that says you're not allowed, it is against the law to beat a Roman citizen. This is the one that Paul knows very well, he's already used once. Where was it? Where did Paul use this last time? Where? Philippi. Absolutely. Remember, they beat him and Silas, and they put him in the inner cell and all that stuff. And then eventually, whenever they say, hey, they find out he's a Roman citizen, they're like, hey, we want you out of here. We want you out of here now. And Paul says, you come in here yourself and come escort me out. And then they go come and do that. What does he do? I'm going to go hang out at Lydia's house for a couple hours. And you just sit outside, do whatever you want. Not leaving yet. He knows this one really well. So what's Lex Porcia? What is that one? Cannot bind a Roman citizen. What's Lex Valeria? You cannot beat. And there's a third one. The Lex Julia. Lex Julia, this was a law, or I guess it's a law, but you could also call it a right. We separate those two. They wouldn't have. But this is the right to appeal to the emperor to satisfy the judgment in your trial. As a Roman citizen, if you did not feel like you were getting a fair trial, you could appeal to the emperor, and it would fall under this law or this right, the Lex Julia. You would be allowed to be tried, which I am sure was connected with Julius Caesar. Whenever he is unjustly, without a trial, murdered. I'm sure that that's the connection. I don't have evidence of that, but that'd be my guess. Okay, you need to know those because of what happens next. These are laws, and you do not violate these laws. If you do, you will feel the full thrust of Rome. And you don't want to feel that. It's not like marshmallows. It's swords and knives and brutality and... As they stretched him out to flog him, to beat him for answers, Paul said to the centurion standing there, "Oh, before you beat me, just have one little question. I can't remember. Is it legal or not for you to flog a Roman citizen? Is that kosher? Is that okay for you to do? Even if he hasn't been found guilty of anything, I mean, is it okay?" When the centurion heard this, he was like, "Hey, man, why are you asking me that question?" Why are you asking me that question? You know Lex Valeria. Or why do you know Lex Valeria? He went to the commander and reported. What are you going to do? He asked. This man is a Roman citizen. See, what's the problem here? It's not just that they were going to beat him. What's the problem? They've already broken the first one. And they're about to break the second. And you don't break any of these. More or less, break this one and start to break this one until he reminds you shouldn't. Then the commander went to Paul, naturally, he's freaking out, and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "Yeah, I am." Imagine that. "I speak Aramaic too." Then the commander said, "Well, man, I had to pay a huge, big price for my citizenship." As a matter of fact, we know the name of this Roman commander, we know from Acts 23:26. When he writes a letter to send Paul on to Festus, Felix, excuse me. Festus comes after Felix. Acts 23:26, he says his name is Claudius Lysias. Now, if you had to guess, this guy bought his citizenship under which emperor? Claudius. Because whenever you become a Roman citizen, you take on the name of the person. One of your three names will belong to the person that actually gave you the honor of being the Roman citizen. Whether that's your father or the emperor or whatever. This guy, under the emperor Claudius, more than likely paid a big price. And we do have evidence from the Roman histories that Claudius's wife was a bit of a tramp. She just really liked multiple affairs going on all the time. And one of the ways for her to pay to keep it secret from society and to keep it secret from her husband is she would sell Roman citizenship for a really high price so that she could pay for her escapades. More than likely, if I'm piecing all the history together, Claudius Lysias probably bought his Roman citizenship in order for the emperor's wife to sleep around. Now, isn't that interesting? Rome is so weird. You know, like Nero's having an affair with his mom, and then he kills her, and Claudius is just as gross. And okay. I had to pay a big price for my Roman citizenship, and then Paul's like, huh, you did? I was born a Roman citizen. It just gets worse. You see, people that have to buy their Roman citizenship, they're in a shameful category. It's not completely shameful. They still have the rights, but they're not as noble, not as honorable as the people that were born. I am pure-blooded Roman, Paul says. This guy's like, well, daggone, I had to buy mine. And Paul's like, man, you're in a heap of trouble. You're not just going to get your Roman citizen pulled away. You're probably going to get killed. I mean, that's not good to be you. But I was born a Roman citizen. Those who are about to question him withdrew immediately. They don't even want to question him now. I'm not questioning this guy. I'm not being implicated in this. Because when Rome hears about this, someone's head's going to roll. And it's not mine. I'm out of here. Even those that were questioning him withdrew. The commander himself was alarmed. He's like, oh, what if I release the guy, he's going to start a riot. If I keep him chained, I'm going to die. I mean, either way, I'm messed over. This guy's a big problem. When he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains, he was freaking out. He's like, oh, man. But, you know, I mean, you understand the problem. He's looking for a typical Roman. Typical Romans don't speak Aramaic and Hebrew. They're not kosher Jews. Most Romans. Matter of fact, most Romans hate the Jews. They're annoying to them. They've always caused problems for them. They tolerate them. So you can understand how he made the mistake, but it is a huge mistake. The next day, verse 30, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, see, that's really kind of funny, because this is going to be the fourth time he's going to try to figure out what the problem is. He doesn't know. He's tried three other times. He tried in Acts 21, 33 through 34. He puts Paul in chains initially whenever everybody's beating him up. He puts him in chains and he says, what's going on here and what happens? Crowds start yelling, he's doing this, doing this. He's like, all right, forget it. Matter of fact, they start freaking out so much. Remember, the soldiers had to carry him into the barracks. And then once he gets into the barracks, in Acts chapter 21, 37 through 22, 1, Paul, right before he's on the stairs going into the barracks, he says, let me say something to the crowd. Claudius is like, good, man, I want to know what's going on anyway. Starts to talk, ends in a fury, big problem. Then he's like, all right, I'm going to beat him, and now we're going to get some answers. He goes to beat him in Acts chapter 22, 24. The third time to get some answers, the Roman citizen thing gets in the way. Fourth time now. Claudius is going, what is wrong with this guy? What is this guy's problem? The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him. Oh, that's smart. Because then what he could say is, oh, the reason why I kept him in prison over the night is because I didn't want him to get hurt. I was protecting a Roman citizen. So I didn't have him in chains throughout the night. He was, you know, in a cell, but it wasn't a cell of imprisonment. It was a cell of protection. So the next day he's like, oh, I'm going to release you to talk to the Sanhedrin. It's still somewhat controlled, but he releases him. And he ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin. You got to stop right there and think about what Paul's seen. This would have been a highly emotional moment for Paul. When's the last time Paul was in the presence of the Sanhedrin? What's that? Yeah, Stephen. 20 years earlier, where Paul was standing as one of the key up-and-coming leaders of the Sanhedrin. And now he's looking at those that were his mentors before, that invested so much time and effort into him, training him in the right ways of the law. And now he's even looking at some of his peers that Paul was even ahead of 20 years earlier. And now they're sitting in the seats all staring at him with hate, judging him because of his faith in Jesus. It's got to be an incredibly intense emotional moment. Because sometimes homecomings are beautiful. Sometimes they're just incredible, emotional for that reason. You're going to be experiencing that in about a day and a half. I mean, some of you, this has been the longest you've ever been away from home. I get that. I was there. Some of you, maybe they don't even want to go home. Homecomings are usually always emotional, both either good or bad. This one's intensely bad. Because Paul's staring at the people that were once his friends and family, and now they're looking at him ready to kill him. The only thing holding them back is the iron fist of Rome. Paul looks straight at the Sanhedrin and he says, "My brothers, I fulfilled my duty to God in all consciousness to this day." He said, I honestly feel like that I have so passionately pursued God at every moment in my life that I lay my head down at night and I feel good. That's a goal to strive for. Make your life so obedient that you can honestly sit back and say, I feel good. I don't feel like there's anything that God has asked me to do I haven't done. I don't feel like there's anything that I haven't sacrificed for the kingdom. I mean, there's just nothing. I would do and I have done everything I could in my zeal for God. I have a good conscience. And if you don't, there's a real easy way to get one. Do what God says to do. It's very simple to say. But you know what? Sometimes I think our Christian humility gets in our way. I think Christian humility is great. Frankly, there's a lot of people on this campus that need to be more humble than what they are. I'm one of them. I get it. My wife really helps me with that, actually. So do my kids. So does my community. But sometimes it gets in the way. Sometimes we're not even honest with who we are. I mean, I want you to live your life so much where you can look at people and say the same thing Paul said. Follow Christ, or follow me as I follow Christ. Why? Because if you're following what I'm doing, if you do what I do, you'll be right next to Jesus because that's where I'm at. That's not an arrogant thing to say. That's something all Christians should be able to say. And if you can't, it's not a problem with humility. It's a problem with the way that you're following Jesus. You should be living a life such that if somebody looks at you and says, "Man, I want to be like you," you look at him and say, "Good. Because if you're going to be like me, you're going to be like Jesus." You know, the whole mentoring thing, it kind of freaked me out initially whenever I started taking on people and said, I'm going to pour my life into your life. Because I was like, "Who am I? Who am I? I mean, I'm a mess." And I felt God saying, "Then clean it up. I don't understand. I mean, if you've been living longer than them and you actually have some wisdom and I can use you to guide you, maybe the problem is you're not living the way you should and that's why you feel guilty trying to lead someone. If you feel guilty being a leader, maybe it's because you're not doing what's right. Being a leader is harder. Loving and mentoring people and ministering to them is harder than merely following. Because you are supposed to be holding yourself to a higher standard. And that's okay. And ultimately, when you're living out that standard, it's also okay for you to say, "Follow me as I follow Christ." It's a good thing. I hope many of you will be able to say it. Not because you're arrogant, but because you just are walking with Jesus so stinking close. It's like, you know, there's a couple of... for example, there was a hire recently at my church. And I didn't know much about the guy. And so the way I asked other people about him was, "Do I want my kids to be like him? Do I want my kids to be like him?" I intentionally have certain people consistently around my kids because I want my kids to be like them. And I understand very clearly it takes a community. There will come a day when my kids will not listen to me as well as they listen to other people. And I want to make sure the right people are around them. So whenever my son's like, "Yeah, I want to be like my Uncle Jay," I don't get upset. Or his Uncle Jay. It's my brother. I don't get upset and say, "You don't want to be like Daddy?" No, I'm like, "Good, you be like Uncle Jay. He loves Jesus." Or, you know, whenever he's like, "I want to be like Uncle Stephen." Good. Be like Stephen, because I know Stephen loves Jesus. I'm okay with that. Because I want them to follow these people as they follow Christ. It's also called a cloud of witnesses. You ever heard of that language from Hebrews? It's one of the reasons why I think it's a travesty in our movement that we don't pay attention to the saints. You should aspire to be like Francis of Assisi. You should aspire to be like St. Augustine. You should aspire to be like them because they loved Jesus. So pattern your life after them. Because ultimately, if they are so good, be like Mother Teresa, who is now in sainthood. If you're like her, you'll probably be walking close to Jesus. It doesn't mean you worship them. Frankly, Catholics don't either. We just don't understand what they're doing. So we assume that they're worshiping them, and they're not. What's praying to saints then? Why don't you have someone close to you die? And then you ask me how praying to saints is bad. Make sense? May I tell you what? My mentor died. His funeral was on my birthday, May 2nd, this past year. And I told my wife, I said, it was a couple weeks later, a couple months later. I said, I think I understand the whole praying to saints thing now. I didn't before, now I do. Because I'll catch myself talking to Doc. I'll catch myself. Matter of fact, inside my office, if you pull back my door, I've got three pictures of Doc right before he died. The last time I saw him, the last time we hugged. And in the morning, whenever I'm prepping for classes, sometimes I'll be going over something I'm not really sure. And just out of streamline of consciousness, I'll just say, man, Doc, I'm not understanding this passage. Or the other day, I was praying to Jesus. And I said, oh yeah, Jesus, by the way, tell Doc, there is a relationship that I have with him that goes beyond the grave. I'm not praying to him because I distrust Jesus. I'm praying to him because I miss him. And I don't think God's saying, Shane, you're sinning. Stop doing that. You ever had a woman, a mom who's lost a child? And she will not peel that picture away from her. It's always with her. Sometimes she'll even talk as if the baby's still there. Sometimes it's a natural way of grieving. And the way in which these people became saints that people talked to was they made such an impact on their community. People missed them so much they found themselves talking to them. And I don't think God's up there going, you only talk to Daddy. I think he's saying, I've surrounded you with a great cloud of witnesses. Follow them as you follow me. Is this making sense? Don't get me wrong. Catholics do get some stuff wrong. But sometimes we make them get stuff wrong when they really haven't gotten it all that wrong. They don't think that Mary... let me back up. They don't all think that Mary is their Redeemer. Although, there is a doctrine that does tend to go that direction. They don't think Francis of Assisi is Jesus. But they're like, man, that guy is so close to Jesus. I want to talk to everyone that loves me. Is this making sense? I want you to live your life so much that you can say, follow me as I follow Jesus. And you impact people's lives so deeply that whenever you go, it's hard for them not to want to keep talking to you. Because that's how much they're connected to you, because when they're connected to you, they feel connected to Jesus. I think community is something he actually gave us when he died, not something he's fighting with us because we love it. Is this making sense? Are you following me? Everybody tracking with me? Or is Shane rambling on something that doesn't matter? Anybody? No? I have fulfilled my duty to God and all good conscience to this day. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered to those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. What did he say? What did he say? Why did he hit him? Why did he hit him? Don't be afraid. Why did he hit him? Yeah. Yeah, because of the way his last discussion ended. God sent me to the Gentiles. He gets up there and he says, I have a clean conscience. Obviously you don't, you evil person. Because you're blaspheming God by saying that he's the one that sanctioned your evil ministry. So he punches him. Or has someone punch him for him, because the high priest won't make himself impure with that type of action. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Oh man, that's brutal. That actually is the same language that Jesus uses to describe the Pharisees in Matthew 23. Matthew 27-28 says this, woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. That's Jesus talking. Mr. Rogers, Jesus. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness. And Paul looks at him and he says, yeah, you go ahead and punch me, you whitewashed tomb. On the outside, oh, you're high and mighty. But on the inside, you are a dead corpse. Now, Paul will regret this kind of in a minute, because he doesn't exactly know it was the high priest that told him to hit him. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Paul's training in Pharisaic law comes in handy here, because he knows Deuteronomy 25:1-2 backwards and forwards. Deuteronomy 25:1-2 says, when men have a dispute, they are to take it to court, and the judges will decide the case, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty. If the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and have him flogged in his presence with the number of lashes his crime deserves. Notice, in that text, when does the punishment come? After the verdict. Paul says one line and he starts to get beat. Paul says, you're judging me by the law. I haven't even given you anything. I haven't even given you my defense yet. That whenever you hit me or punish me before the law, or before I've even given my defense, you're violating the law you're claiming to uphold. You claim to be righteous. You claim to be holy, but you're dead inside. You claim to be so clean, but you're obviously unclean. You don't care about the law. Because if you did, that would not have just happened. Those who were standing near Paul said, you dare to insult God's high priest? Paul replied, brothers, I didn't realize he was the high priest. Now, that could be taken in a couple of different ways. Number one, it could mean ignorance, the way I read it. He could have said, man, I had no idea. I'm sorry, I didn't know. If I would have known, I would have acted different. But why doesn't he know? I think maybe will lead to kind of the double ambiguity of the statement. Because he could be talking in sarcasm. He could be saying, really? That's the way your high priest acts? Sorry, I didn't know he was the high priest. He could have said that. Problem is, we don't have voice inflection. I think it's a little bit in between. I think Paul really didn't know. I think one of the reasons why he may not have known is because Claudius Lysias may have said, you're not going to come in here with all your garb, all your height. You're not going to sit in your places of honor because I sit in the place of honor and no one's going to be out honoring me inside this presence. So he may not have allowed the high priest to have the garb on. And he may not have allowed the high priest to even sit in the position of honor because Claudius Lysias himself may be sitting there. Is this making sense? Paul may literally not have known who that guy was that commanded him to get punched. And you also have to know that, man, Rome was changing high priests so often. Paul hasn't been here in 20 years. He may not have known that this was the current reigning high priest. It's possible. Nevertheless, I think what Paul's really getting at is, sorry, it confused me as the high priest, because I didn't think the high priest would have been violating the law. I was confused. I would assume your high priest would be acting in accordance with the law. But how foolish of me to assume such a thing. Brothers, I didn't realize he was the high priest. For it's written, don't speak evil about the ruler of your people. He says, I know the law backwards and forwards. Had I known that was the high priest, although the fact I didn't know may be an indictment on him, that's neither here nor there. My intention is not to break the law. It never is. And therefore, I don't want to talk against him. At the same time, someone needs to hold them accountable. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out to the Sanhedrin. Now that's a really important detail. Remember, we've talked about the Pharisees and Sadducees so far, right? How do they differ? Pharisees, theologically, would be considered the theologically what? Yes, you said it. Conservative. Liberal. The theologically liberal, because they believe the whole Old Testament as well as the oral traditions. The Sadducees, on the other hand, would be the theologically conservative, because they only take the first five books of the Old Testament, and everything outside of those they don't believe. But you have the Pharisees over here, who are the politically conservative. They're the ones that they will not even sniff around Rome without having a gag reflex. Where the Sadducees would be the politically liberal, because it doesn't matter as long as their agenda is being pushed. Sadducees have their geographical location of power in Jerusalem. Pharisees have theirs in the synagogues. That's the differences. Paul knows their differences backwards and forwards. Why? Because he was a part of the groups. He was a Pharisee, and that's what he says. Knowing their Pharisees and Sadducees, Paul cried out to the Sanhedrin. My brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of the Pharisee. And half the Sanhedrin's going, oh good. He's on our side. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. Ooh, smart. See, what was happening was getting out of control. Paul says, I'm going to gain the upper hand again. I know the key problem here. Sadducees don't believe in a resurrection. Why? Because it doesn't happen in the first five books of the Old Testament, so they claim. Jesus actually challenges that in Mark's gospel whenever they ask the question about the marriage at the resurrection. Nevertheless, they don't believe in a resurrection or angels. Pharisees do. They believe in it passionately. So what happens? When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, "We find nothing wrong with this man at all." The people that were accusing him now are defending him because they have something bigger at stake politically. "We find nothing wrong with this man at all," they said. "What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him and given him his mission to the Gentiles? What if that has happened?" Sadducees says, well, the spirits and angels couldn't, because there is no spirits and angels. There are no resurrection. And Paul's going, go ahead, friends. Just fight. Well, kind of. The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down there, take him away from them and by force and bring them into the barracks. And once again, Claudius Lysias is going, fourth time, and I've got no answers. They're bickering about stupid stuff. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." And Paul's going, good, because that's where I've been wanting to go the whole time, Rome. We will be on our way to Rome next class period, which will be after Thanksgiving. No class tomorrow. Have a fantastic break and come back refreshed and ready to dive in. Love you guys.